Kip Tindall is not a household name, but his store is becoming a national icon. Which store? Well, I'm talking about The Container Store, that big box store that satisfies all of our minor, major, and latent OCD needs. Kip Tindall has been at the helm of The Container Store since it first opened its doors in Dallas in 1978, and he is the chairman and CEO. But why talk about another big box store? Well, The Container Store is different, and it's not run like your typical business. So to find out what is different, I've asked Kip to join me today to discuss his new book, Uncontainable. Kip Tindall, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Very happy to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
So take us back a little ways when you and John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods Market, were housemates, and you met your partner, Garrett Boone. Tell us how that all kind of came about.
Oh, well, John Mackey, in fact, I was at John's ranch just this past weekend. John's the co-founder of Whole Foods, of course, and he and I, it's just crazy, but we were college roommates at the University of Texas, and somehow we both went off later and immediately after school and started retail businesses. And of course, The Container Store and Whole Foods are very, very different companies, but we do share an almost identical business philosophy in terms of, you know, servant leadership, conscious capitalism. You know, we put the employee first and believe in our yummy, quirky employee first culture that if you truly, I mean, if you take better care of your employees really than anybody else does, that employee really will take better care of the customer than anybody else. And if those two people are ecstatic, your shareholder is going to be ecstatic too. And lo and behold, John is attempting to do something, has done something with Whole Foods that's very, very similar to that. So John and I don't agree on politics. We don't agree on a lot, but we agree on almost all business philosophies, and we're still good friends after all these years. And I was with him this past weekend. Garrett Boone and John Mullen and I got together along with the help of some other people and spent a year or two or maybe even a little more investigating the concept of things for your domicile, for your home or office that are functional in that they save space and even more importantly, save time. I think Whole Foods has had the tailwind of people becoming more and more conscious about eating better. I think The Container Store has had the tailwind of we're all so crazy, multitasking, can't get it all done, insane, you know, and so you have no choice but to be reasonably well organized in order to get half of what you want to get done in life done.
But Kip, let me just stop you for a second. You know, that all makes a lot of sense today. But in 1978, selling empty boxes, that must have been, you know, thought of, especially you're out of Texas. I would think people would think, what are you really thinking there, Kip? You know?
Yeah.
What were you thinking back in 1978?
Well, we loved these products. It was driven by the products. We loved the fact that it got you organized. We were aware of a certain zen quality to being reasonably well organized even then. We had a foggy notion that it saved you time. Clear cut, it saved you space. There was no product. It was Gray Lion and Rubbermaid and maybe two or three vendors that sold a few of these things. So we had to sell products that had never been sold before in retail, commercial and industrial products, a leaf burner that would be great to hold the swimming pool balls and toys and whatnot. And it's great because you can see through it and tell exactly where that soccer ball is on the bottom and that type of thing. Egg collecting baskets as a gardening tool thing. So we got very excited about the product. Opened a tiny little 1,600 square foot store dedicated to storage and organization. We overcame people like my father's friends who said that, now you boys are going to open a store that sells what? Empty boxes? It's kind of embarrassing.
Exactly.
And, you know, we believed in our concept. And then about, just several weeks after opening that first tiny little store in Dallas, the president of Rubbermaid came in and went crazy over the store and loved it. Stanley Marcus came in and went nuts over the store. You know, we started to get really important business people that we admired to give us the encouragement as very young entrepreneurs to, you know, without that kind of encouragement, I'm not sure we would have had the self-confidence to, you know, to do it. But when you have Stanley Marcus and the CEO of Rubbermaid telling you you're doing a good thing, that helps.
How much did it cost for you to get started? What was the initial outlay to start the first store?
Yeah, we had $35,000 in capital to start the business with, and $35,000 was not very much money in 1978 either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't think we ever spent more than about half of that. We were so worried about running out of cash. So
yeah.
We were very difficult for the vendors to deal with because we'd order about six of everything and then reorder it twice a week.
This is Kip Tindall I'm speaking with. He has a new book called Uncontainable. He is the founder, chairman, and CEO of The Container Store. When did you know, what number store was it that you knew that this was really going to work? Now, this is question number one. Number two, did you benefit from technology and the change in materials? Because I was thinking way back when you had Rubbermaid, you know, things were kind of heavy and clunky, and today there are so many new materials that are lighter and stronger. But first question, you know, when did you know you were going to have a hit?
Well, I think the first day with that tiny little first store was mostly friends and family. But by the end of the first week, the store was so busy that we were contemplating issuing numbers like then Baskin and Robbins did, where you could get in the door when somebody else left. So we never really went through the entrepreneurial terror of, are we going to make it or not?
Yeah.
3 or 4 days in, we knew we had something. And I would think that when a musician goes to the studio and records one of the all-time great hits, they know it.
They know
it before they leave the studio. And
yeah.
We had that feeling and that excitement. And then it was just a matter of, we kept doubling the size of the store. We were sort of philosophically opposed to opening a second store because we weren't sure that we could do the same excellence with that.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we got over that, and we did 2 stores. And by golly, that second store was just as good as the first store, so then there were more. But we still only have 70 stores
uh-huh.
in 35 years.
Yeah.
They are all 25,000 square feet now.
Yeah, right.
The first one was 1,500 square feet. But mm-hmm. we still are kind of committed to cautious excellence and not just expanding to be expanding.
So you went from running a store where it was a question of bringing goods out in from the back door and putting them on the shelves, treating customers well, and having them fly off the shelves from the front door. But now you're also in the business of trying to find the right people, especially growing this fast. And this is, I think, where there's a demarcation between your philosophies and many of the other philosophies we see in today's world, how you treat your employees. First of all, let me say that you pay your employees more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we pay our employees more. We, corny as it sounds, we love our employees more. We train them more. The average retail company spends 8 hours of formal training for each first-year employee. We're right at 300 hours of formal first-year employee training.
Hmm.
The average full-time salaried person on the sales floor makes about $48,000 a year, which is about double industry average. We try to pay 50 to 100% above industry average, and particularly for those people closest to the customer, that's closer to double. We don't pay the CEO 50 to 100% above industry average. In fact, I make below industry average. Try to get the vice presidents at industry average. We really try to pay the salespeople well. And our payroll philosophy and our hiring philosophy is that one great person is equal to 3 good people. So if you believe that one great is equal to 3 good, hire only great people, train them, pay them, develop them, and something else happens. Great people are more productive, so the business wins. Great people can help a customer better, so the customer wins.
Mm-hmm.
But who do you like working with? Great, engaged people or mediocre people? Great people help you attract other great people because
yeah.
I want to go to work in the morning and work with great people, and everybody does. So people join this company and they never leave. And they're great people that have been here for years. And I'm telling you, if you go into the store nearest you, the person that comes up to wait on you has probably been there for 4, 8, or 16 years. That's exciting in retail.
So the idea of being in retail as a career is something that I think is somewhat different than many other retailers. This idea that you can actually make a career here. This is not for the bubblegum chewing, teenager who needs a summer job. You're really trying. 300 hour commitment to training is a lot. And if you had a lot of turnover, that would be extremely expensive, right?
Yeah, you couldn't do it. That's why it's not done in retail. The industry average turnover in retail is triple digit, over 100% a year, which means the average retail employee in America does not even make it through the year. We're 10%.
Mm-hmm.
We lose people occasionally to, we lose them to love. their significant other is, you know, something like that. Yeah. But 10% is a pretty great number in this day and age. We're very proud of that.
You know, you mentioned love, but it's funny, when I was reading the book, I was thinking of love, L-U-V, which is the symbol for Southwest Airlines. I have interviewed the CEO there as well, and he tells a story very quickly of how one of the top pilots came to see them, and this guy had all kinds of awards. He had been in the military, and he was just one of the best pilots. But they ended up not hiring him because he was really quite arrogant and mean to the secretary before he got in to see the person who he was talking to, and they said, this is not the culture that we want. So do you think from time to time that you're modeling yourself with Southwest Airlines? Is there a similarity there in your mind?
I wouldn't say we're modeling after Southwest Airlines. I consider Herb Kelleher, the founder, to be a friend and really a mentor, and I've learned a lot from him. We're both very conscious capitalist companies. Our company is based on a set of foundation principles, which the book goes into a lot.
Yeah, I'd like to hear some of those.
And also the tenets of conscious capitalism. And then in Herb's, you know, Southwest Airlines, Whole Foods, Costco, Google, these are companies that kind of practice this conscious capitalism thing. In fact, the reason I was at John Mackey's ranch this weekend was to have a conscious capitalism board meeting with a lot of similar other people. But you're right. Southwest Airlines is a great example of that. And you can feel it when you're on the plane. The flight attendants are a lot more engaged, a lot happier, and treat you a lot better, don't they, than they do for most airlines. And it works well because that makes them want to stay. It makes me want to fly their airline. I think it's true that no airline long-term has been as profitable as Southwest Airlines.
I agree.
Same with Whole Foods. They've done great. Same reasons.
You have mentioned the term conscious capitalism. What does that really mean when you say that term? You were at a board meeting about conscious cap. What is conscious capitalism?
Well, conscious capitalism, John Mackey and a guy named Raj Sisodia wrote the book on conscious capitalism. It's entitled Conscious Capitalism. My book, Uncontainable, has a great deal to do with conscious capitalism. But there's several ways to, in kind of shorthand, talk about conscious capitalism. Maybe the easiest way is to just say that despite what you may have been told when you were a child, business is not a zero-sum game. Someone doesn't have to lose in order for you to win business. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The real money is being made by people who form win-win synergistic relationships with their employees, with their vendors, with really all of their stakeholders. You know, a lot of people think that the management team should focus first and foremost on the shareholder. Shareholders are very, very, very important, but there are more stakeholders than just a shareholder. Your employees are a stakeholder, your vendors are a stakeholder, the community is a stakeholder. And so if you optimize the needs of all of those stakeholders rather than just focusing entirely on the shareholder, you magically wind up with a happier and more profitable shareholder.
Mm-hmm. So substitute the word stakeholder for shareholder, and it broadens the field of all those who have a stake in your success.
Yes, that's called the stakeholder model, which is really key to what conscious capitalism is all about. So we talked about it earlier. Take better care of your employee than anybody else. You'll take better care of your customer than anybody else. If those two people are ecstatic, your shareholder's going to be ecstatic too. But I tell you, if you myopically focus only on the shareholder, oftentimes your employees and your customers won't be that happy. The magic's lost, and the shareholder won't be happy either. So, you know, that's why employees come to work for the Container Store and never leave. That's why customers don't like the Container Store, but love the Container Store. And that type of magic, Costco's a pretty good example. Costco pays its average employee just about double what its nearest competitor does, and yet they do much better.
They're very profitable as well, too. What is on the horizon for the Container Store?
Probably the biggest merchandising initiative we've ever done is our TCS Closets, where Alpha, most people know our Alpha closet system. It's shelving and sort of mostly wire, great closet and pantry organization. But now we're doing more of a built-in version of that. It's a little bit even higher end. A lot of older, a little bit higher end customer might want this in their master bedroom, Alpha in their guest room. So it's more solid, not exactly wooden, but that's a huge thing. I think what happened was we said, you know, we want you to buy Alpha because Alpha is a company that we like so much, we actually bought the factory.
Uh-huh.
So now we're saying, you know what, whatever she wants. So she wants Alpha, she wants this TCS closet.
Whatever she
wants. We're also finally doing something the customer's been asking for 20 years, which will come to your home and do it for you. We'll design it with you. We'll rotate your closet for you. We'll install it. And that's pretty gigantic, too. So those are two of the biggest things we're doing, along with what we call POP. We're finally doing a loyalty program, a frequency program. And when you sign up for the POP program, perfectly organized perks, you become a POP star. And that has been hugely successful.
That's
people
great.
Are, you know, I mean, you want credit for your purchases and your frequency to your favorite store. I know I'm that way.
Yeah,
I get frustrated at people who don't have it.
Yeah.
I don't know why it took us 35 years to do it. We finally have done it. People like it.
Well, Kip, I'd like to keep talking, but unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest, Kip Tindall, CEO, chairman, and founder of The Container Store, in his new book, Uncontainable, a great read. Thank you so much for joining us, Kip.
Thank you, Steve, so much. Enjoy it.